Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope names 6 new cardinals. Pope Benedict announces a consistory on November the 24th, where he will give red hats to prelates from Lebanon, India, Nigeria, Colombia, the Philippines, and to the American who is prefect of the pontifical household. What Nigeria needs. Find out how a bishop from northern Nigeria views the challenges facing his country, including the violence carried out by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram. And Syrian families caught in the line of fire. We speak to an official from Catholic Relief Services who recently met refugees from Syria in the neighbouring countries of Jordan and Lebanon. Pope Benedict has named 6 new cardinals who will be given their red hats during a consistory in the Vatican on November the 24th. The 6 cardinals designate come from America, Lebanon, India, Nigeria, Colombia, and the Philippines. The Pope's announcement came at the end of his Wednesday general audience, where he spoke about the nature of faith. Emma McCarthy reports.
Con grande gioia annuncio che il prossimo 24 novembre terrò un consistorio nel quale nominerò 6 nuovi membri del Collegio Cardinalizio.
The new cardinals come from 3 continents, America, Asia and Africa. And they are Archbishop James Michael Harvey, prefect of the Pontifical Household, who will be appointed Archpriest of the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls. His Beatitude Beshra Boutros Rai, Patriarch of Antioch of the Maronites in Lebanon. His Beatitude Basilios Klimis Thoktonkal, Major Archbishop of Trivandrum of the Siromalankara Church in India. Archbishop John Onaekin of Abuja, Nigeria. Archbishop Ruben Salazar Gomez, Archbishop of Bogota in Colombia. And Archbishop Luis Antonio Tagle of Manila in the Philippines.
I nuovi cardinali, come avete sentito?
The cardinals, the Pope said, have the task of helping the successor of Peter in the performance of his ministry, of confirming the brethren in their faith, and that of being the principle and foundation of unity and communion of the Church. The November 24th consistory will be Benedict XVI's 5th, and he will have created 90 cardinals. On that date, the College of Cardinals will be composed of 211 members, 120 of whom will be eligible to vote in conclave, being under the required age of 80 years. In a geographical breakdown of current cardinal electors, Europe counts 62, Northern America 14, South America 21, Africa 11, Asia 11, and Oceania 3. Earlier in his general audience catechesis, in the second installment in his cycle for this year of faith, Pope Benedict XVI spoke of the nature of Christian faith in today's world.
More than simple knowledge about God, faith is a living encounter with Him. Through faith, we came to know and love God, who reveals Himself in the life, death, and the resurrection of Christ, and in so doing reveals the deepest meaning and truth of our human existence.
Pope Benedict concluded that today's world needs Christians who have been seized by Christ, rooted in Scripture, and open to the gift of grace of the Holy Spirit. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Here in the Vatican, the Synod of Bishops on New Evangelization is now in its final stretch, with the Synod Fathers working on the draft of the propositions that will form the core of the concluding document. Among the participants of the Synod is Bishop Matthew Hassan Kuka of Sokoto in northern Nigeria. So, what are the main challenges facing his nation? and how concerned is he by the violent campaign carried out by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram that has often targeted Christian churches in northern Nigeria? To find out more, I sat down with him during a break in the synod proceedings. I began by asking him what ideas from the synod he will take back to his own diocese.
Well, I've actually always believed that, first of all, like St. Paul said, our salvation is something we should be working for in fear and trembling, and that really seeking the face of God is an ongoing experience. I worry, for example, that in the West, where we say religion is more or less not being actively practiced, I see the fruits of religion, let me put it that way, that is a certain level of human conduct, the way society is run, the respect that people have for human rights, the value they have for life, and so on and so forth. And I contrast that very sharply with the environment where I come from, Nigeria and most parts of Africa and the developing world, where the churches are full, the mosques are full, and we are visibly, really, really proudly religious. But there's very serious deficit that we encounter. The levels of armed robbery, the lack of respect for human rights, the diminution of human life and the value of human life, the endless cycle of violence around places of worship perpetrated by quote-unquote believers and so on and so forth. So for me, and the corruption. So for me, these are really sharp contrasts, and they raise some really profound questions about what we consider to be faith, what the challenges are. You know, so for me, these are some of the problems that I think I will take home and continue to wrestle with.
As you said, you come from a diocese that's in a predominantly Muslim area. And as we have seen, many parts of northern Nigeria have been the scene of attacks by the radical Islamic group Boko Haram. How worried is the Christian community by these attacks, by this group?
I don't deliberately play down, but I like to insist that, you know, that I'm living in Nigeria with other Nigerians. So I don't spend my time thinking of the fact that I'm living with Muslims. You know, I'm living with Nigerians as citizens of a country. And I like that emphasis to be made, precisely because we have, the Western media has not, and even the local media in Nigeria has not helped us believers by focusing too much on our identities as Muslims and Christians. And those two identities are just one out of many other identities that people have. But to come back to the point, the problem with Boko Haram is not a problem between Christians and Muslims, despite the fact that the easy part is to say churches have been attacked and so on and so forth. But perhaps it is also important to note, you know, that we have had the same experiences within the Muslim communities in Nigeria, and that what we are dealing with is the need to appreciate the fact that every Nigerian citizen, by just living in Nigeria, is a potential victim. And I think that is very worrying. And I think that, I mean, once we take that position, then it becomes slightly easier for us to deal with the question of holding the state and the government of Nigeria squarely and fully responsible for doing the very basic things that governments are set out to do, namely to protect the lives and properties of ordinary citizens. And I think this, for me, this is really what the issues are, not a conflict between Christians and Muslims, because that is really not what Nigeria is faced with, despite the fact that it has become very popular. But it is seriously misleading, and it distorts the facts and doesn't present the problems that we have in the proper manner.
Talking of the government, the military has launched a crackdown against Boko Haram, and this has been, it's been criticized by many as very heavy-handed and not really tackling, let's say, the roots of the problem. Would you agree?
Well, not the military. The president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria has to call out the military. And I have argued severally that theoretically, that is really not the right thing to do, because we're in a democracy. And my argument has been that the issues that Nigeria is dealing with are issues that politics ought to be able to resolve. And because this is what political engineering is all about. How do you manage and negotiate consensus? I mean, the problems of the IRA had to be finally negotiated. Every problem, every form of crisis anywhere in the world. And I worry that the Nigerian political class has hidden its incompetence by simply presenting the problem as a law and order issue. It is not. So sending the soldiers out in a democracy my argument is that theoretically it diminishes your capacity to win the trust of ordinary citizens. So what I see in the response of the federal government of Nigeria by falling back on soldiers is that the government is actually hiding its incompetence. The government is using proxy institutions to deal with issues that are purely and simply and squarely issues of politics and negotiating consensus. Because the issues that Boko Haram is talking about are issues that other Nigerians, including myself, have talked about. How do you continue to run a country with such monumental corruption as an institution, with clear and blatant misuse and application of state resources? I mean, you don't need Boko Haram to confront this problem. And my argument is that even if you brought all the soldiers of the world, you don't kill an idea. The only alternative to dealing with the problems of Boko Haram is for the Nigerian political class to squarely deal with the issues of governance, namely to reduce very seriously the high cost of government, the incentives that have made access to government so attractive and by extension so violent. What has happened in Nigeria over the last few years is that younger people have become very aware of the fact that politics in Nigeria is almost like armed banditry. And because the price is so high, and because the climate of impunity has become so dominant, these are the issues that you need to deal with. And they're not issues that guns can deal with. Because what is also even happening as a flip side of that is that the security agencies are now getting a piece of the action. And they're literally becoming like an alternative state. If you go back, if you listen to what is happening in Maiduguri and other places, in most of Borno State and in some of the areas, ordinary citizens are saying, we actually are suffering more from the military than from Boko Haram. They've become like an army of occupation. Now, you always, anywhere, you need the confidence of citizens to be able to operate. So for me, the continuous stay of the military on the streets of Nigeria, one, diminishes democracy, but also it makes it increasingly difficult, for us to deal with the issues of Boko Haram.
But is there a feeling among northern Nigerians that too much power is concentrated in the south? There is a real grievance there, isn't there?
No, I don't think that is. I don't think that is true. First of all, you just have a bunch of thieves across the Niger in different directions. So the real issue is when the thieves in the north feel they're not getting a piece of the action, people then make the case that there is concentration of power in the south. But the power that has been in the south, we've had, I think, 9 or so heads of state in Nigeria. Almost all of them have come from northern Nigeria. For almost 20-something years, Nigeria was governed by a bunch of northerners and Muslims. So that's not the issue. The corruption did not diminish. It didn't start yesterday. And in fairness to Goodluck Jonathan, the poor man has only been president for barely 1 year. He's supposed to be president for 4 years. So I think that the whole argument that there's concentration of power in the south, so what? There is concentration of power, of resources in the whole of Nigeria. So the question is, the political elite in Nigeria cannot cover its irresponsibility by holding somebody else responsible, because clearly what politics has become in Nigeria is that the question we are morally asking is, how is it that the state has become merely a distribution agency, and that the basic things that ordinary people elsewhere in the world have come to take for granted, access to health, running water, light, jobs, these very basic things the rest of the world, including many parts of Africa, have come to take for granted, they're not available in Nigeria. If they persist, it will be Boko Haram today, it will be somebody else tomorrow.
Do you agree with those who say that Nigeria's tragedy, given its huge oil wealth and everything and the potential it has, is that it's not been blessed with good governance?
Well, a lot of the issues also, there are certain historical realities. It's not enough to have the resources. It's not even enough to be in government. In many parts of Africa, you have people who are in office, but they're not in power. In part because the oil business is run by multinational corporations. I just finished a 7-year negotiation between Shell and the Ogoni people to end the irresponsibility of Shell in Nigeria over a particular period of time. This is the story. Democratic Republic of Congo should be one of the richest countries in the world. So it's not enough, even when we talk about corruption. It's also important for the international community to appreciate that multinational corporations, international businessmen are also committing serious crimes as far as issues of governance are concerned in many parts of Africa. I'm not making an excuse, but I'm just making the point that good governance is not just a blessing. It's something you have to work on. And I think that the other problem with Nigeria is that we've been independent for 52 years. But out of those 52 years, the military has been in power for over 30 years. And during the period of the military, people learned a lot of bad things, including good people who behaved terribly badly. Now, getting people's sense of confidence back in processes, in the discipline of democracy, is going to take time. Because under the military, there were no institutions. I mean, every institution was severely compromised. The judiciary, the various ministries, the civil service. The problem is that now Nigeria is beginning to think, feel its way. But it's going to take a long time. You still have that mindset, and it's going to take us, I think, a while to wean ourselves through that process and then for ordinary citizens to become a bit more confident again in the process. The issues are not about good luck, Jonathan. It's about us having the discipline to roll our sleeves, do the good work, and appreciate the fact that all of us have to become honest and transparent.
I was speaking to Bishop Matthew Kuka of Sokoto in Nigeria. In Syria continues to rage, and ordinary families are being caught in the line of fire. Scenes of the bombings, shootings, and airstrikes are amply played out across the screens of the world's media. But what about the civilians whose lives have been turned upside down by this brutal civil war? More and more Syrians are fleeing to neighbouring countries like Jordan and Lebanon to escape the daily violence, often with only the clothes on their backs. But how are these refugees faring in their host countries? And what kind of war stories have they experienced? One person who recently met Syrian refugees living in Jordan and Lebanon and saw with her own eyes the extent of their plight is Carolyn Brennan, a senior communications officer at Catholic Relief Services.
It's even getting worse for the refugees that are flooding across the border. And what was so particularly striking for me when I was meeting with them is how thoroughly blindsided these families were by what is happening. They never expected this. Many Syrians I met described having watched the Arab Spring just like we did, you know, from a distance, as viewers, never thinking it would touch their life, never imagining it would reach where they live. And so they are very surprised by what is happening. They're shocked. Many described the humiliation of being in this position. They are a country that used to host refugees, Iraqis, Jordanians, Palestinians, and now they're in a position of having to ask for help. I wish the situation was still in the news as much as it was a month or a few months ago, but the situation is dire for so many people who never expected to be here. They never started this fight. They are families, they are women, they are children, and they're absolutely caught in the line of fire.
Do you have any idea, or does anybody have any idea, how many people are fleeing Syria each week, each month, and whether that exodus is increasing or not?
The exodus is definitely increasing. The official estimates of refugees, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, as of October 23rd, was 358,000 refugees. But that figure is very low. It represents the refugees who have fled into Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and Iraq. But we have to keep in mind that so many families are afraid of registering formally for aid because they fear that if their name is officially put somewhere, it shows that they may have fled, either serving the government as a soldier. Many men have fled not wanting to do that, or it may show that they were in dissent of the government. So a lot of people are just not registering for aid, and they're trying to find assistance in the cities and communities. So that figure of 358,000 people, many in the aid and international community, are doubling that figure. And they estimate that there are about 3,000 people crossing the border in any of those countries on any given day.
Can you share with us some of the more heart-rending stories that you heard when you met these Syrian refugees during your visit to Jordan and Lebanon?
You know, as a woman, I found that I was in a very fortunate position to be able to hear the stories of women. We often are seeing the images from this crisis of men fighting in the streets with guns, and you see the shooting and the buildings that have been toppled. But when you're there, you see only women and mostly children that they have in tow. And we don't see those images as much because traditionally in this part of the world, women are not comfortable being photographed, but they are everywhere, and they're pulling you to the side, and they're raising their sleeves of their long dresses, and they're showing you their bullet wounds, and they're begging you to not only hear their story, but to tell their story. So I met many women. One woman I met described the moment she knew she had to flee, and that was when she was going to the bakery with her mother, and they heard all this gunfire around them just outside the bakery, and she just turned to look where it was coming from, and she saw her mother lying on the street next to her, shot twice, and her son was with her, and he just was in shock, and she had to carry him and leave. And her husband, when they got home, was just said, basically, run, 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 go. And that is a situation that so many people fled during. It was in a moment's notice when people came into their house, stormed into their homes, and their husbands turned to them and said, run. And so many people don't have their papers. They don't have their money with them. I met another woman named Yazi in Lebanon, and she fled across the border with her two sons under five, and she was 8 months pregnant. Her husband had stayed behind to protect their home, to protect their land. And Yazi was very smart in trying to find aid. She did not want to register with any organization. She was afraid. She essentially knocked on the door of a modest-looking Lebanese home and said, if you give me shelter, I will work for you for nothing. I just need a place for my sons to sleep and for me to sleep. So when I met with her, with my colleagues from our local partner, Caritas Jordan, they were doctors and a social worker who were checking in on refugees like her who aren't registered anywhere, but they're in these cities and towns. And she had her baby, which was in her lap. And my colleague, who was a nurse, asked her about her delivery. And Yazi said, well, I don't know if you understood me, but I'm not making a fee here, and I don't have a way of paying at the hospital. So I delivered here in this room, you know, by myself. And my colleague looked at her and said, but have you seen a doctor since? Has your child seen a pediatrician? And she said, no, I really don't know if you understand me. I don't have a way of doing that. So we immediately offered her and her two sons a ride, essentially, to our clinics. And we arrived at the clinic, and they received, you know, just wonderful health care from, you know, the doctors there. And there are hundreds of women at these clinics.
And what do you find are the greatest needs, the things that these people really need?
Medical care is such a significant need because so many people are coming across the border with injuries, with wounds from the fighting, or there are mothers who are pregnant and need care for delivery or for their children. So our agency and many agencies in the area are really having to staff up their gynecologists, their pediatricians, and their doctors. Basic food and relief items, again, these people have fled on a moment's notice with nothing. So they don't have means for shelter. They don't have means for feeding their children, for food. They don't have money to buy it. So we provide soap and ways to keep your water clean, diapers for the children. And then emotional counseling has been a big request among the refugees who show up at the doctor's offices, especially for the children who have witnessed some pretty horrific violence.
Such as? What kind of things, if you could you tell us, what kind of horrific things have they seen?
I met one father and son who were receiving counseling, and the father was describing that when they left, their wife was unable to make it across the border. They've been trying to find her. They left, again, at a moment's notice when they were shooting on their street. They're a middle-class family. This was never meant to happen in their neighborhood, and it literally blew up. And their son saw many people being shot on the street. But when I was with them, the counselor was describing how she gives crayons and paper to children to be able to talk about what they've seen. And right there, just before my own eyes, he was drawing this image of a woman on the street and a man holding a gun. It was a very simple sketch drawing with one crayon, but it was death on a piece of paper and something that's on his mind and that he's seen, and he's seven. And so many parents are asking for help of how to deal with what they've seen, not only just right now in terms of dealing with family separation and having witnessed these things that really no one should see, but how they're going to counsel and deal with these images and impact in the long term. They don't want it to affect their children in the long term.
You talk there about family separations. There was obviously an awful lot of people that where one spouse or the other had to flee. This too must be a source of deep distress, you know, wondering what's happened to the family member left behind in Syria.
The family separation, I would say, is the main source of stress, of grief, anxiety. It's what almost every person I met talked about because of the situation in which they were forced to flee. Stress of grief, anxiety. It's what almost every person I met talked about because of the situation in which they were forced to flee. Men are largely staying behind to protect their land, to protect their houses. They've been inscripted. Many have gone missing. So you find mostly in these camps women, the elderly, and their children, and they don't know what's happening back home. And so there's a lot of anxiety that comes with the decisions they're making for protection, for basic survival, and not knowing where people are and what's happening to them.
And what kind of conditions are these refugees living in the camps?
The conditions for refugees vary. Many refugees are living in actual camps, like you might imagine a refugee camp. So they have the assistance of tents, water within the camp, food, basic relief supplies. Now that winter is coming, the needs for winterization are paramount. So lots of blankets, electric heaters, etc. But then there are those refugees who are too afraid to register. Many refugees are living essentially squatting in available homes or buildings along the border towns and areas. Some have family members, extended family members or friends who moved to these border towns many years ago, and so they're asking for help just to be able to sleep on their floors. I met many refugees who have crowded into one- or two-room houses of very distant relatives or acquaintances who had moved to these towns before and who had welcomed them, but it is certainly a burden on these families because resources are so stretched in the communities already, and there's no way for these refugees to earn an income.
And how crucial would you say is the role that's been played by Catholic Relief Services and your Caritas and your local Caritas partners?
We feel so fortunate because our Caritas partners in Lebanon and Jordan have been in this type of assistance for many years for incoming migrants and refugees along these border areas. So thankfully, we feel equipped with clinics and offices and social services and talented social workers and doctors already in these areas. So we are helping tens of thousands of refugees in across these border areas. The assistance and needs are tremendous, being very stretched to the limit with more people coming in every day and with winter approaching. People are just very much in need of help, but many had a really nice life back home, and now they're in the situation in which they genuinely feel so embarrassed to be in a position to ask for help. They all talk about wanting to go home.
I was speaking to Carolyn Brennan of Catholic Relief Services. As of next Monday, the weekday English feature program will no longer be available on these frequencies in this half-hour format. Our weekend service will not be affected. However, you can find all our news and interviews on our website. That's simply rv.va and click on the English World icon. Please do get in touch to let us know what you think of these changes and how we can continue to provide the best service to all our listeners. We look forward to hearing from you on our email address english@vatiradio.va or on our postal address Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, 00120, Vatican City. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's feature programme. I'm Susie Hodges. Laudato Jesus Christus.